And thank you as well to the attorney for the government. All right. Our next case for this morning is Flores against Nissen. Here's Mr. Brower.
May it please the court, counsel. This is the case for my client with a passenger in a truck being driven by the defendant, and the defendant went through a red light while he was on prescription drugs. It's our position that he was intoxicated by those drugs at the time. And we went through the usual discovery on the case. We got to trial. We showed up for the day of trial, and we walked into trial, and the judge said, well, he wanted to consider a motion for summary judgment that had been filed by the defendant, and so we adjourned the case and took this motion for summary judgment under advisement. The trouble is that the motion for summary judgment, the issue was an affirmative defense of basically the Illinois Workers' Comp Act under Section 5A says you can't sue an employer or a coworker.
And before you get into that argument, I just have a quick jurisdictional question. I know you say in your brief he's a citizen of Mexico. Is he a permanent resident of Illinois, Flores?
Yes.
He is. Okay,
yes.
I just wanted to make sure that
he's lived here for.
Well, if you have
access, yes. That's what I'm trying to get to his legal status.
Is he a legal permanent resident? Because that would affect our diversity jurisdiction.
Well,
illegal, and that's a different matter.
I only represent him in this personal injury case.
I don't know if he's a legal Illinois resident.
My understanding is that he's a citizen of Mexico, and I received no information as to any other status.
But the reason this is important is Section 1332A of Title 28.
Oh yes, I will.
Says for purposes of this section, an alien admitted to the United States for permanent residence shall be deemed a citizen of the state in which such alien is domiciled. And so we would have no diversity jurisdiction, and this whole case would be gone if he is admitted for permanent residence here and he's domiciled here.
That's absolutely correct, and I have been representing him for all these years. I've had such cases where they would be a citizen of Mexico but have what I would refer to as a green card. I think sometimes it's actually pink, but it says that they are a permanent resident. I have not received any information from any source that he has such a card.
But it's your burden to justify jurisdiction. So the default rule isn't jurisdiction in federal court. The default rule is no jurisdiction unless you can show us that he's there. Perhaps
it was never an issue raised by the other side.
Well, that doesn't make any difference, of course, as Judge Williams rightly notes. Perhaps the parties could file within 10 days a statement as to Mr. Flores's status.
Fine, Judge.
So that we can make sure that is not something that strips us of jurisdiction.
I have had cases where that has come up, and I will. I obviously know about the rule.
If your opponent wishes to file anything as well, but within 10 days, each one of you can file whatever you wish on this point.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, it was our position. We showed up for trial. We had submitted our final pretrial order in the case, had done discovery. And then a month before trial, the defendant filed a motion for summary judgment on this issue of that the defendant was an employee.
Now, my question for you
yes.
about that is, in a sense, where's the prejudice? Granted, this kind of thing is probably the appropriate subject of an 8C affirmative defense, but pleadings can be amended, indeed, leave to amend shall be freely granted, et cetera. And it seems from the discovery materials that you've been pursuing that the question of co-employee status was very much at issue. Everybody knew it was there, and it's hard for me to see how this late filing prejudices you.
Judge, I don't think I've taken the position that that was prejudicial to us.
Well, if it's not prejudicial to you, then this isn't an argument we need to worry about. All we need to worry about is the merits of the district court's summary judgment decision.
In fact, that's what I've argued in my brief, that the issue here...
So we can forget about all this, it was raised too late. We can just look at whether the record, the undisputed facts, shows co-employee status.
Yes, I think there's a better issue. I think there's a better issue, and that's why I didn't emphasize it. And the better issue is this. There are genuine issues of fact here as to what his employment status is.
But is that the case based on the Rule 56.1 filing that you did not contest?
It has nothing to do with 56.1.
Well, it has everything to do with those are the facts before us on which we have to assess whether there was a triable issue of fact in this point.
You can take all of the issues of fact that are deemed admitted by the trial court and you still have genuine issues of fact. And here's why. That statement, the 56.1, just deemed certain facts admitted. There are plenty of other facts in the record, in fact, in the pretrial, final pretrial order regarding the fact that they did not withhold taxes, he was not on the payroll, they paid him in cash. I think it's the Ware case that recites seven different factors that the courts consider in Illinois, and it's an Illinois issue.
But they weren't in the 56.1 statement, but these other facts that you've argued in your brief.
No.
You could have filed something that pointed to those, but the problem is you didn't.
You're correct.
Putting it in the pretrial order is not good enough. That's what you're saying. These facts were in the final pretrial order. These other facts.
Not only were they in the final pretrial order, but
right,
the court
considered them. But they weren't with respect to the response to the motion for summary judgment.
Yes.
They were not pointed out to the court. You wouldn't have had to physically rewrite them. You could have referred to the pretrial order and identified them so the court would know, but that's what you didn't do.
I agree.
So that's a problem.
Well, even all facts must be supported in the record. If there was something in the 56.1 that wasn't supported in the record, it wouldn't support a motion for summary judgment. And the court considered, the court never said, for example, in its decision, if you read its decision, it never said that we waived anything. It just said it deems admitted both facts which we didn't respond to in the 56.1, and then it went on to consider, and in his decision, he says, I considered the material in the pretrial order and the material in the exhibits. So the court took those into account. Notwithstanding having taken those into account, it misconstrued the facts because there are facts which, if true, create a genuine issue of fact on the issue of employment status.
Well, but the court says two things. You're looking at footnote one of the court's principal opinion, where he says the court takes the facts from defendant's local rule 56.1 statement, the final pretrial order, and accompanying exhibits. But then he goes on to say plaintiff has failed to file local rule 56.1 response, and the court deems admitted all of the defendant's factual averments that are supported by the accompanying evidentiary exhibits. And I think the problem is your failure to go through the pretrial order and explain to the court why you thought there really was an issue of fact on this employment issue is where you got into trouble here.
Well, it's the context, that's the reason it's in the context in which it arose. You have to remember that they never pled.
But we decided we didn't care about that.
I know, but I mean, in the context of that, that's how that came about. If this had been a normal motion for summary judgment that had been filed in the course of the case and we had responded to it, this was a motion for summary judgment that was filed after the discovery was closed.
That happens more often than not, that the motion for summary judgment is filed after all the discovery is completed, and you were given an opportunity to respond. It wasn't like it was so tight, you know, that the motion was filed 2 days before trial and you didn't even have a chance to hardly respond.
I agree. But usually a motion for summary judgment is filed, but you're at issue. We weren't at issue on the employment status because they had never pled as an affirmative defense under 8C this issue under the Illinois Workers' Comp Act.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at with my initial question. You were exploring employment status throughout the discovery period. All these facts that you're now arguing are from your discovery materials. Who was filing W-2s, who was on which payroll, who was supervising work, all of these things that are pertinent only to the employment question. So it's hard for me to see how anything would have been different during discovery if the actual 8C defense had been sitting there than the way it really was. It seems to me this was on the table.
Well, I think there's a difference between my state of mind and what's on the record. If I
What evidence, is there any evidence that you think you needed to collect had there been an 8C affirmative defense pleaded?
Yes.
Is there anything you would have done differently? What?
Yes. I would have taken the deposition of the accountant in this case, because in this case, one of the big issues was what, if anything, had they paid and what was the method of payment? Had they done any withholding with respect to this driver?
But I thought that came out. That you already knew that there were no W-2 form or withholding of income tax done by the company. That wasn't disputed, was it?
I think it would have been stronger for the trial court to hear it from the accountant rather than the way in which it came in. But the question was asked.
But it wasn't disputed. I mean, the company didn't come back and say, "Oh no, you're wrong. Here are the W-2 form." I mean, that fact stands.
I'm still not arguing that it was prejudicial. What I'm arguing is the fact that the way in which it came about is explained by the fact that they did not plead the affirmative defense until a month before trial. And then we get up to trial, and then right away we had to start getting into this issue. But even all that aside, that to me is a technicality. That's all aside. The important thing is that there's genuine issues of fact as to his employment status given the record before this court, namely the failure to withhold, paying in cash.
But is that disputed? That's not disputed. Did the company say, no, we only wrote checks? I'm saying it's not in dispute that it was cash, right?
That's correct.
Was paid in cash.
So you don't need a trial for things that aren't disputed. I think
that's not a dispute whether he was paid in cash or not.
I agree.
So that's not a material fact in dispute. Maybe it's just terminology that. Maybe the characterization then, whether he's an independent contractor or an employee, that's what those facts.
But if you have that undisputed fact, it's one of the issues underwear that prevents the court from granting summary judgment.
Because you're saying underwear, the ultimate question, whether he's an employee, is in fact for the trier of fact.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. You're in rebuttal time, so we'll hear from you in a minute, and we'll hear from Mr. Postol.
May it please the court, Joseph Postel for the defendant. First of all, on the jurisdictional question, I think I'll probably submit a supplemental memorandum as the court suggested, but I notice on page 2 of the district judge's opinion, he makes a finding of fact that Flores submitted a Social Security number and a lawful permanent resident alien number on his employment application, but that these numbers were fake. That he did not have a valid Social Security number or a lawful permanent resident alien number. So that's some indication that he's an illegal alien. It's always been my understanding that he's an illegal alien. I will look for more information on that in the record and submit it at the within 10 days of today.
Thank you. That would be great.
I think that with respect to the state of the record that was before the district judge when he made his ruling, again, no 56.1 statement was submitted, and there's been a lot of discussion in plaintiff's reply brief and here this morning about the pretrial order. The pretrial order doesn't refer the court in any concise or helpful fashion to the facts that the plaintiff has brought before this court. The pretrial order, at best, refers to exhibits. And the existence of issues. Even if somehow it could be viewed as a substitute for a Rule 56.1 statement, it's a very inadequate one.
Well, Mr. Postel, putting Mr. Grauer's argument in its best light, it seems to me that what he's saying is inherent in the fact that you put forward in your 56.1 statement, which he stuck with. I mean, that's that's clear, are some which might lead to a conclusion of employee status, others which might lead to a conclusion of non-employee status. In Illinois, that's a question for the jury. Therefore, even taking the facts the way you have presented them, it was incorrect to grant summary judgment. So maybe you could comment on that issue.
Well, without sidetracking, getting sidetracked too much, I think for one thing, the Illinois cases are decided, those that deal with summary judgment anyway, are decided under the much different standard for summary judgment than you have in federal court. I think it's probably fair to say that in an Illinois state court under their summary judgment procedure, if there was any dispute as to even one of the seven factors, that possibly would be enough to preclude summary judgment. I don't think that's the standard in federal court, where there would have to be the presence of a factor sufficient to support a finding that he was not an employee before a court could reasonably conclude there was an issue to go to the jury.
And so basically, because in federal court, judge-jury allocations are a matter of federal law, you would say that these Illinois cases don't have the weight.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Judge.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting the court ignore them, but for example, here, all that the plaintiff has is that no taxes were withheld.
Well, he's got that he only worked for the company 3 days in the year 2000, that he paid in cash, and there were no payroll or employment files kept on it.
Right. I don't think the fact that he was a sporadic employee alters the fact that he was an employee, and certainly there's been no authority furnished to the court to support such a statement. And the fact that no taxes were withheld has been recognized by the Illinois Supreme Court as not sufficient to overcome the inferences and conclusions which would flow from the other factors, such as the right to control. The case law is clear that the right to control the activities of the employee is the paramount factor. There's no question that that right existed and that it was exercised. New Beginnings told Mr. Nissen where to take Mr. Flores, at what time, what equipment to bring, that sort of thing. So the element of control is clearly here. There's no genuine issue about that. And all of the other factors, save the withholding taxes and the sporadic employment, are present and indicate that he was an employee. So I don't think there was a genuine issue here. Even if there was, it certainly wasn't properly presented to the court. Frankly, I think to suggest that a genuine issue existed here would be to impose a burden on the district judge to search through the voluminous record. And if the court is saying the Rule 56.1 statement that we submitted, I mean, it's very thick. There are a lot of depositions. There are a lot of records attached. And to suggest that the district judge had to go through all these things himself and search for other facts is really an intolerable burden on him. They could have been submitted in a Rule 56.1 statement. He had 2 weeks after our motion for summary judgment was filed in which to respond, and there's just no reason he couldn't have filed a 56.1 statement.
But why didn't you plead this as an affirmative defense? It seems to me it was clearly... it is clearly an affirmative defense under 8C. I don't take it that you're really disputing that. And
no.
Normally, you have to put people on notice that you're raising affirmative defenses so that they can focus their efforts during discovery. It strikes me that at a minimum, this was it caused a lot of problems in this case that didn't need to be caused.
I don't dispute that, Judge. I guess it's kind of weaselly to point out I wasn't trial counsel.
Well, why do you say that anyway?
Get you off the hook.
I don't know why trial counsel didn't play it. But,
okay, maybe that's why you're here. okay, because really, I mean, there's a reason and reason why we try to structure things this way, and you can go through a lengthy process of saying, well, it wasn't raised, and permission to amend the pleadings, and then refiling, and so on, but I take it at this point there's no dispute that there was no prejudice, and under this circuit's
right.
law, that's pretty much the end of that argument, which I take Mr. Brower agrees
I
with.
Think so.
So. Okay.
There are no other questions?
No. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Grower, we'll hear from you for 3 minutes.
I think the core issue still is whether or not there exist issues of fact sufficient to grant a summary judgment here. And well, it seems to me that...
Let me just ask you this. Do you agree that the most critical factor in making the determination between whether someone's an employer or independent contractor is the right to control the work and supervision?
Absolutely.
That is the most important factor.
The courts refer to that as the most significant factor.
So therefore, these other things are minor and don't rise to the level of a dispute such that it should go to trial under Illinois law.
No, that's not correct. That's not correct. There's a difference between whether it's significant.
So let me ask you this. Do you have any cases?
It's not determinative. It's one factor. It's the most important factor. But of the seven factors under Ware, we have three or four factors going against that factor. And the factor of control is not by any means something that has been it's undisputed in this case. We dispute control because here you have a truck driver, and you know, truck drivers on the road, half of them are independent contractors, half of them are employees. That's an issue that still has to be decided in this case. So we do not agree that control was stipulated or agreed in this case. But what we're saying is that there are clearly undisputed factors, taxes, withholding, cash payments, only working for 3 days, stuff like that, which is enough, sufficient to create a genuine issue of fact or a trier of fact in federal court, state court, any court.
But I thought the 56.1 statement said, as a potential undisputed issue of fact, that David Nissen indeed did control Leonard.
Well, let's assume that it did.
Well, that's the point. I mean, you know, if you agree, you know, if you agree to that, then you have the control factor settled. Right?
Well, that would be true. I don't understand that to be in those 56.1 statements, but I would take it.
We can certainly look at it, but
sure.
If it's there, then that factor is settled.
That would be true.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel.